We are back here on CKUW 95.9 FM. You're listening to People of Interest. I'm your host, John Wilson, and I'm speaking with, right now I have on the line, actually, it's the media critic, and he's been a journalist for over four decades at least, and he was also well known for being one of the first to question 9/11 on international or national television, and he's also written the book Towers of Deception, the Media Cover-Up of 9/11. It's Barry Zwicker. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's a real pleasure.
All right. So first, Barry, I wanted to speak about the Toronto hearings on 9/11 that you're co-organizing. So could you get into what the purpose of these events are and what you hope to accomplish?
Yes, indeed, John. I do need to clarify something, though, that you said a moment ago.
Sure.
It's not quite right. I'm not co-organizing the Toronto hearings, but this will become clear as I try to respond to your very good question.
Mm-hmm.
There are actually two separate, independent events concerning 9/11 truth, shall we say, in Toronto this coming weekend. So the first is what you just mentioned, the Toronto hearings,
mm-hmm.
More specifically the Toronto hearings into the events of 9/11. And they take place from the 8th, Thursday, through Sunday, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And I'm on the advisory committee for the Toronto hearings.
Oh, okay.
And so that's one. The second event is a single one-off event on the evening of September the 11th here in Toronto. And this separate event is one that I've initiated myself. I'm the sponsor and the host of it.
Okay.
And it will be devoted just to one aspect of 9/11, and that is what happened and what did not happen at the Pentagon. So that's just a clarification that's needed. There's some would say that the two there's I would say there's not a hostile relationship between the event that I'm sponsoring and the event, the Toronto hearings that I've been involved with. But some people might think so, and that might even be something we can talk about later.
Mm-hmm.
But we consider our event, the Sunday evening event, to be separate or independent, and the Toronto hearings will bring out, no doubt, a lot of very valuable information, for instance, about the way that the Twin Towers and World Trade Center 7 in New York City on 9/11, were actually demolished by controlled destruction. That the story of the Twin Towers being hit by airplanes, which they were, of course, but which then caused the so-called collapse of these buildings, is something that defies laws of physics and so on. The regrettable, I would say, part of the planning for the Toronto hearings, which I was a small part of,
mm-hmm.
is that the Pentagon, what happened and did not happen at the Pentagon, will, I fear, not be dealt with nearly enough. And that is why I sponsor this separate event.
I see. So specifically, I guess the Toronto hearings goes over several days, and so what kind of people are speaking there, and what are they going to be, I guess, what kind of evidence are they going to be speaking about?
The Toronto hearings are heavily concerning New York City, mm-hmm. and so this will be the main focus, I would say, and I'm just going to put in my Google, and anyone can do it, Toronto hearings. I'm just doing it now with one finger,
mm-hmm.
and I think there you go. It comes right up, and the focus will be on the World Trade Center, but also one of the topics will be the insider trading that some of your listeners may be aware of. Prior to 9/11, there were huge trades took place which were very odd. concerning, for instance, United Airlines and American Airlines. And this kind of trading is where people bet that, and I think bet is the correct word. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call it proper trading. It's more like a casino. People bet in advance that the stocks of United Airlines and American Airlines and some other companies too, for instance, big financial companies that had offices in the World Trade Center, that the stocks would go down. And if the stocks would go down and somebody made a future bet that they would, they collect a whole bunch of money. And in fact, this was done. And the authorities, the Securities and Exchange Commission in the USA, have consistently for 10 years refused to release any meaningful information about who made those bets. But I would say myself, just if I can throw in an opinion here, mm-hmm. it's the kind of thing the CIA would do. Because many people don't know how financially plugged in the CIA has been from its inception. It's Michael Rupert who pointed out, this was news to me when he pointed it out back in 2002, that 10 of the first 11 directors of the CIA were Wall Street lawyers. The CIA has always had a big black budget of its own. And I think it's pretty well known, I hope your listeners are aware, that the CIA has been involved in illegal drug running worldwide for decades, and so on. So it would be just like the CIA to have inside knowledge, of course, because 9/11 was an inside job, to have inside knowledge it was going to happen and say, whew, how can we make a whole lot of bucks out of this for our black budget? So that's going to be discussed. It'll be actually discussed by Paul Zaremka, a friend of mine who teaches at the University of Buffalo. And so that's one of the most important things. The Pentagon may be dealt with slightly. That is a famous 9/11 truther, rightly famous, David Ray Griffin, mm-hmm. Who's just is about to have launched his 10th book on 9/11. My gosh, and he didn't start writing these books until, I believe, 2003. His first book was called The New Pearl Harbor, and it's still a classic. And then since then, he's written 9 more books about 9/11. And he's going to discuss at the Toronto hearings anomalies of Flights 93 and 77. And actually, I don't know exactly how he's going to handle this, and I will personally be attending as many of the sessions of the Toronto hearings as I can, and I certainly don't want to miss his session. I also consider him a friend, and in my book, Towers of Deception, that I think you mentioned, mm-hmm. I have a whole chapter devoted to the work of David Ray Griffin, and that book came out in 2007, and even then, he was like a pillar of truth-seeking in the 9/11 truth movement. And so it'll be interesting to hear what he has to say. And so I think that maybe there'll be, for instance, people such as Niels Harrit. Now, Niels Harrit is a Danish scholar, and his field is mainly chemistry and so on. And he's done some very good work about how the Twin Towers and Building 7 in New York City had to be brought down by explosives. He's done work on nanothermite, this incredible substance that burns so hot. It can either burn hot or explode fast or both, and that would be the substance of choice to bring down those towers the way they came down. By the way, there's something kind of interesting. I was just reading a column this morning in the Toronto Star, a column by Heather Malik. And there's so much appearing now as we approach the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Mm-hmm. And Heather's take on things is that they featured with her column a picture of, it's a horrible picture of a man falling. You know, he had jumped from the Twin Towers and he's falling. It's a famous photograph now, and they put it in there. And Heather, not even speaking metaphorically, the picture, besides being a sort of a moment of tragedy, of horror, but also she said that everybody's been falling for 10 years since 9/11, you know, civil liberties being stripped, wars being fought, and the treasury being robbed for hyper-militarism. And so this is something that she said. She also said that it just took 10 seconds for this man to fall to his death. And then she compares that with 10 years of a falling economy and all that. Well, interestingly, 10 seconds is also the amount of time it took for each of those twin towers to fall. In other words, both those towers came down in less than the time it takes a telephone to ring twice. Now, anybody who thinks that's a natural collapse, where huge millions of tons of steel would have to fall down on other millions of tons of standing steel, which would slow the collapse down. So anybody who thinks that those buildings came down naturally through airplane impact and then jet fuel weakening beams and then collapsing in a pancake fashion just has to think back. How could that happen in 10 seconds? It couldn't, really. And of course, another thing is that the buildings were turned to dust, and a building that would collapse doesn't turn to dust, it just collapses. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm getting too far into this, perhaps. It depends on how much your listeners are interested in this, John.
Well, I'm sure the ones who are aware probably are well aware by this point. Maybe the ones who aren't should look more in depth and take what you're saying. Maybe check for themselves to see if the videos are still available. People can actually watch the buildings collapse on any videos if they want to check to see what you're saying is true. It's pretty easy for anyone to look at this evidence, although I know a large percentage of the public has not done so, including maybe a lot of your journalist colleagues. You mentioned some of the media coverage. What can people expect from the mainstream media coverage, as this 10th anniversary, of course, is going to take up a lot of newspaper and TV media space, I guess, over the next few days? What do you expect to be the main focus here?
Well, it's already the drift, shall we say, the nature, the character of the coverage is already coming into focus quite clearly. Mm-hmm. And I want to throw in, by the way, before we're finished, I very much am anxious to answer some of your questions and tell more about this other event that will take place about the revelation of what happened and what did not happen at the Pentagon,
right,
at our public meeting on Sunday night, just so we plant that sort of idea in our index cards. But anyway, to respond to your question, the coverage I've seen, and I've been watching CBC television, I take three newspapers, the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, and the National Post, and of course I've been listening to radio and reading Maclean's and so forth. And it's a terrible thing to say. I mean, it is just one of the worst criticisms that anybody could make, is that the coverage moving into the 10th anniversary is no better than the coverage we've had for the last 10 years, meaning that the media, by and large, with just a very few honorable exceptions, have shown no interest in even questioning the official story of 9/11, let alone investigating it. And the Toronto Star, I won't mention names here right now, but the Toronto Star last weekend carried a very short piece which was actually literally garbled in places. I mean, there were just lines of type that just didn't make sense in it. But anyway, they ran a piece which included five questions about the official story of 9/11. And as far as I can see, that story, which didn't have all that great a headline, which was actually garbled, and but which put five pretty good questions, about the towers and who benefited from 9/11. The writer, and this has disappeared without a trace in that, for instance, there have been no letters to the editor about it. It was a small piece, came and went. And as far as I can make out, A, that's all the Toronto Star is going to have by way any kind of questioning of the official story of 9/11. B, the writer told me that she doesn't think the Toronto Star has anything to be ashamed of in its coverage of 9/11 over the past 10 years. And she is the most questioning member of the Toronto Star staff. I mean, what a commentary. And so there's been this lack of investigation. That's why I wrote my book, Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11. So I wrote a whole book about it, 416 pages, 100 illustrations, and has a DVD in it, too. And it's still selling well, I'm happy to say. Mm-hmm. As well, it should, because of its subject matter. But there, but on 10 years later, no investigation, and in fact, there's a complete blackout, an almost total blackout, on those of us who question the official story. And so the coverage is going to be maudlin. It's focusing on personal tragedies, for instance. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't diminish anybody's personal tragedy, not for a second. But my gosh, to focus on these personal stories, the Star is running one a day on Canadians who died in 9/11. There were 26 Canadians died in the Twin Towers on 9/11. And the Star is running these profiles about the, based on interviews with the survivors, with the widow or the widower. And so this really is just focusing on the what we used to call a sob sister element of 9/11, and then other people are so the irony is that the Toronto Star, to name one, is looking at personal tragedies without asking the question, who caused all these personal tragedies? Who was behind the demolition of the buildings that killed all these people? Mm-hmm. I mean, how can you deal? If you want to take it back down to the personal level, and I mentioned this to the Toronto Star writer, I said, look, you know, if your sister had been murdered, and let's say it's coming up to the anniversary of the murder of your sister, and let's say you didn't know who murdered your sister. It's a mystery. The police haven't found out. The police aren't even working on it. Wouldn't one of the most healing bits of closure, as they call it, be for you to find out really who murdered your sister and why? Mm-hmm. I mean, wouldn't anybody want to know that? We know that when people go missing, they're just not found. It's horrible for their loved ones. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just, what happened? I mean, this is like the disappeared in Latin America, the people who were dropped out of helicopters into the sea and because they criticized the government. And it's a lifelong pain not knowing, not being able to go to a gravesite and put flowers on it. Well, so all these newspapers that are running these maudlin pieces are really disrespecting the victims. And yet the National Post had the nerve to run, I believe it was on a front page, to run a piece questioning whether the Toronto hearings should even take place while people are mourning again on the anniversary. I mean, what hypocrisy. I mean, it just boggles the mind. A paper that has done no investigation, that has demonized those who want to ask questions, and then questions even whether there should be questioning around the time of the anniversary, which, as I said before, they have done for 10 years anyway. So the anniversary is just really a reinforcement of the dreadful hypocrisy, and I wouldn't even call it the failure of the media. I would call it the success of the media in imposing de facto censorship on any questioning of what really happened on 9/11.
Barry, I also wanted to mention the irony that is the all these family members, specifically you could point to the known as the Jersey Girls, the four widows who had to fight tooth and nail to get any investigation started, which ended up with the 9/11 Commission, and which didn't answer the questions they wanted. But these family members, so many of these victims, are the ones campaigning to get you know, the truth out, to get all these questions that have lingered answered. And so when people say, you know, you shouldn't question this because of the family members, it's they make up a large percentage of the people, I guess, wanting these questions answered. So that also throws, you know, on its face that argument of how, you know, how this could be disrespectful when it's the family members who want, you know, who want the questions answered. Well, I'm sure some don't want to talk about it anymore, or they just want you know, they haven't looked into maybe the specifics, or they've bought the government story. But I know that I still see, you know, people like Bob McElvain, who lost his son. He's part of that campaign in New York, this ad campaign, that they're still trying to get questions about the buildings and Building 7, you know, answered in a public arena. So what do you, you know, you've I'm sure you've heard a lot about the family members who are still actively campaigning, right?
Oh, for sure. I just, you know, I quite agree with what you've just said, John. And I had written down, before you mentioned his name, Bob McElvain. Mm-hmm. I know him personally. And he is so touching and powerful in his campaigning for the truth about 9/11, in the name of his son, which he will never let go of the flame. He's doing it for his son, Bob Jr. And I've heard Bob speak maybe three times and met him personally. And I'm glad you mentioned the Building 7 campaign, because if people, I don't know how, whether maybe probably just Google Building 7, and there's a powerful campaign, and there's a terrific short. I mean, I think it only runs a minute or something like that. One of the best done TV ads I've ever seen, and Bob McElvain is part of it. And it's just a series of people, firefighters and the families of victims and policemen and I think an ex-CIA person, just coming on in fast. We see their faces quickly, and they just say, I want a new investigation. I want to know what happened, you know, for the truth, for the country, for history, for my son. And so if you Google either Bob McElvain, M-C, cap I-L-V-A-I-N-E, or better probably Google Building 7, and there's or Building 7 campaign probably would be it. Mm-hmm. And the Jersey Girls, of course. And I headed up an inquiry back in May of 2004, the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11. And that was a six-day inquiry at the University of Toronto, and we had 40 presenters from three continents. And one of the presenters was Ellen Mariani, who lost her husband. She was on one of the flights. I'm sorry, I forget which one. And she's been struggling for years to try to get the truth out. Most, as a matter of fact, of the families of the victims were bought off by the U.S. government, because the U.S. government offered a large sum to any family member, a survivor of a victim, who would sign a statement saying they would never take any legal action against the U.S. government. And most, regrettably, most of the families did sign that, thereby tying, you know, their mouths shut forever. But you know, in fact, I mean, I guess they could still speak out, but they couldn't do anything substantial. And why would the U.S. government be worried about lawsuits against itself if it had nothing to do with it? You would think the U.S. government would have offered them $1 million each or whatever it was for something to do with Al Qaeda, you know, if they would pursue Al Qaeda, something like that. But I wonder, John, would it be okay with you if we just turned for a moment, because it's an upcoming event that's very important to the to the other event in Toronto this weekend.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, what it is, and anybody who's listening and is on the net could just type in National Security Alert, and click on the second item that comes up, The first one is a video, which is okay, but the second one actually takes you to the website of Citizen Investigation Team. And their main video, their main DVD, is called National Security Alert. And so the Citizen Investigation Team is a small number of relatively young Americans. The two that I'm bringing to Toronto, and they'll arrive tomorrow, and then we'll have spend time together planning and so forth, and then have this event on Sunday evening, and I'll just give a couple of specifics about it in case somehow anybody's going to be in Toronto or has friends in Toronto. It'll be at the Royal Cinema, and that's 608 College Street, College at Clinton. Mm-hmm. The Royal Cinema, doors open at 7:30 this coming Sunday evening, September 11th, the very day of the 10th anniversary, and the presentation starts at 8 p.m. Now, featured will be two members of Citizen Investigation Team. One is Craig Ranke, R-A-N-K-E, Craig Ranke, who lives in California, and the other is Adam Fishman, F-I-S-C-H-M-A-N, who hails from Pittsburgh. And they have a dynamite presentation because they'll show National Security Alert, which has, as they say, disturbing eyewitness accounts of what happened at the Pentagon, which also automatically covers what didn't happen at the Pentagon. And they will intersperse it, as I understand, and if not, it'll be somewhere else in the program, with other evidence that they have found from their years of investigation just into the Pentagon aspect of 9/11. And also, just I have an old friend who's going to say some words prior. I'll introduce with general remarks the evening, and then this old friend of mine will make some remarks. And I say old friend twice because he's 101 years old, mm-hmm. Sidney Bacon. I think he should be called Sidney Beacon because he's so concerned about corruption and war. And so I'm going to have my 101-year-old friend, Sidney Bacon, say a few words. And there'll be ample time for question and answer. So we're looking forward to this separate independent event, as I say. The last session of the Toronto hearings will be Sunday afternoon. I'm not sure when it'll end. It may end at 4:30 or 5:30, something like that. And then ours, as I say, the doors don't open till 7:30. So we've planned our event so as not to cause a scheduling conflict with the Toronto hearings. And so we need 200 people to break even financially and get my visa back on the level. So anybody who can spread the word about our event, of course, I'm unashamedly plugging it.
I see. So it's good that all the bases can be covered there. I guess that would be a lot of information to take in. But if anyone's in the Toronto area, that is definitely something to check out. I wanted to shift the focus back onto a specific media coverage. Now, like you said, it's mostly focused on individual stories of mourning. But also, anytime I guess the 9/11 truth movement or criticism of 9/11 does come out, there's been it's usually ridicule or just bringing it up to discount it. And you mentioned the National Post, and I know they have that writer. It's Jonathan Kay, right? Who is their main 9/11 truth critic, right?
Yeah.
And he's come out with a book recently. As well, say, as he has been sort of trying to embed himself in with the 9/11 truth movement to see them from the inside. So, what is your take on his book and his writings about the 9/11 truth movement?
Well, it's hard to be kind. It's hard to find a kind word for Jonathan Kay. I know him personally, and he has done some good work. I don't mean to be condescending, And speaking of condescension, this is one of his main faults. He is so condescending to, for instance, those of us who dare to question the official story of 9/11 in any way, shape, or form. So this is the main thing that comes across. There was a on May the 13th on the current affairs program, The Agenda, on TV Ontario. The host and interviewer Steve Paikin, who's done a lot of good work, had Jonathan Kay on as his guest for the first 15 minutes. It's a one-hour program, and often the format is they have a single person who's a guest for 15 minutes, approximately, and then the other 40 or so minutes, there's a panel of 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe as many as 6 people who then discuss the topic that has been central in the conversation with the guest. And so Jonathan Kay was the guest that evening, and then there were 3 of us who were on the panel, and that was Richard Gage, who's done marvelous work. He's the inventor of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, AE 9/11 Truth, as it's called. And then Paul Zaremka, who I mentioned earlier in our discussion here from Buffalo, who came up from Buffalo to be in the studio here in Toronto. And when and just to give you some flavor of what I think about Jonathan Kay and his work, which is the main question you asked, and maybe a little more, is that after we were settled, and Steve turned to me and he said, "What do you think of Jonathan Kay's book?" And I said, "I believe that he has written a profoundly dishonest book." And I said it that way. And a very curious thing is that Jonathan Kay didn't react like a normal human being to this tremendous slam that you know, I delivered, but I meant it most sincerely because I'd read his whole book from stem to gudgeon, and it really disgusted me in so many ways. And he refused to look at any of the evidence that there could be questions about that upon which questions about 9/11 could be based. But he went into intense over psychologization of those of us who do ask the questions. And for instance, my case, because I was referred to by name in his book, he suggested that, you know, I'm having a midlife crisis and that this explains why. Well, I'm well past having a midlife crisis. And anyway, I didn't ever have a midlife crisis, and I'm not having one now. I think anybody could pick that up from this conversation. But this is so condescending and demeaning to label people as being defective, really, mentally and emotionally. And so it's name calling of the worst kind, and it's condescending, and he was very dishonest. So I thought my daughter said something revealing. You know, I said to her afterwards, I said, you know, he didn't come across as a normal person. And she said, "No, you know what he came across as?" And I said, "What?" She said, "He came across as a military person." In other words, it takes tremendous discipline to be told to your face on air that you are profoundly dishonest and not to, you know, raise an eyebrow, but just go on as if it wasn't said. And so I can't help but thinking that not Jonathan Kay, considering his super dishonesty, and considering that he co-authored a book about Mossad, that he works for some military-type organization. I'm not saying he's on a payroll, but he might as well be, because he just performs the role of a psychological warrior, and he's doing as much damage as he can to honest, authentic citizens like myself and many others who are asking legitimate questions about it was, in the case of 9/11, specifically an event that clearly changed history. And I might throw in something else about the media, since you asked. Mm-hmm. Last night on CBC television, and I know we're coming to the end of our time here, on The National, there was a report by Adrian Arsenault, and I personally have always had tremendous respect for Adrian Arsenault. I just actually, in my personal opinion, she's the best they have, and McDonald's pretty good too. But anyway, Adrian is the tops. And she decided, and I don't know how it was decided, whether it was her idea that she initiated or an idea that came from elsewhere, but anyway, she took on an aspect of 9/11 that is so underreported and underinvestigated, and has been underreported and underinvestigated for 10 years. And that is, how much has this surveillance and spy community benefited from all the fear-mongering surrounding 9/11 and the allegation that 19 crazed Muslims, you know, did this terrible deed? And the answer is just absolutely startling. Like, she interviewed Dana Priest, who's a reporter for the Washington Post. Now, Dana Priest and William Arkin, another excellent writer, a year ago July in the Washington Post authored a three-part series called Top Secret America. And in that, they brought out that, for instance, there are 856,000 Americans with top secrecy clearance, and that the whole spy community is totally out of control in the states, and that there are something like 10,000 locations where surveillance and spy people work, and there's something like 1,300 separate organizations, and there's so many of them that they can't even keep track of each other. And right now, and this was new to me, they showed aerial views of huge buildings still going up in Washington, D.C. Like, one of them's bigger than the Pentagon, and it's just going to be full of spies and agents and surveillance people, and the National Security Agency. So, in other words, when you ask who benefits from 9/11, well, one clear beneficiary, immediate beneficiary, was the Bush regime. Another was all their buddies in the military-industrial complex, because the military budgets which were already swollen in a ridiculous way, just swelled even further. And the latest is that more than half of the national income of the USA, even when it's suffering so badly that they're talking about cutting off Medicare and daycare and everything, that more than half of the budget of the USA goes into the military. I mean, it's just really a distortion that's beyond words. And last night on CBC, and I guess people could find it archived on the CBC website, Adrian Arsenault had this terrific piece, which I would highly recommend. But anyway, Jonathan Kay goes on doing his work. A little sidelight, to that is that the National Post, in an editorial, called me by name a 9/11 denier. Look how sneaky that was. The usual phrase is Holocaust denier. Mm-hmm. And also another thing is that there's a claim, a desperate and defamatory claim, that 9/11 truthers are anti-Semitic. So these two things get tied together, you see, the Israel question and the 9/11 question. And so in the National Post, I was called a 9/11 denier, and I was called a nut bar. Now, I didn't want to write a letter to the editor. That's too, you know, not enough calories there. So I contacted the National Post, and the editor, the commentary editor, was none other than Jonathan Kay. And I said, Jonathan, I want to write a rebuttal. And you have got this little column at the bottom, 750 words. I want that, and to do a rebuttal, because I've been attacked by name and defamed by name. He said, sure, you go ahead and write. So I wrote a piece, which I, with tongue-in-cheek, I used as a byline by Barry, open parentheses, nut bar, close parenthesis, Zwicker. And it summarized things, I think, quite well. Well, one person had an extremely high opinion of what I had written. I wrote exactly 750 words, and they were well chosen. And the person who thought it was an excellent column was Jonathan Kay. And he called it extremely lucid, mm-hmm. which is pretty high praise. So then he emails me and says, unfortunately, we can't run it. And so I sent him an email, and I said, why? And he said he couldn't say. So in other words, there's censorship. I mean, you really feel a sting of censorship at the National Post. It is a profoundly dishonest newspaper. And so to have a profoundly dishonest journalist working for it makes sense, doesn't it?
Right. All right, Barry. So we just have the last couple of minutes here. And I guess maybe to finalize this, could you sum up, I guess, what has been the result of 9/11 and the fact that it hasn't been questioned enough publicly to make any waves with the decision makers, the politicians, and the media? What has happened to the world in the past 10 years as a result of this censorship, as you put it?
Well, the legacy of 9/11 is to have caused what I guess is called a paradigm shift. The American Empire always seems to have, always needs an enemy, and I guess every empire does, because it's an organizing construct for people to have an enemy. It appeals to the simplistic in us, the black, white, either or, yes, no side of us that says if you're not, if you're a friend of my enemy, you're my enemy, and so on. And so there's this simplistic dualism. And for most of my life, the simplistic dualism was anti-communism, was capitalism versus communism. And so communism fell, as it's put. Actually, communism, I feel, was pushed rather than that it fell. And they had to have a replacement in order to justify the arms industry especially, which is a cancer, absolute cancer in society. And so they found terrorism, and then specifically they goosed it with Islamic terrorism and so-called Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda being an organization that was in fact invented by the CIA. Amazing. Most people don't know that. And the result of 9/11, the legacy of it, is that the paradigm shift has been from anti-communism to anti-terrorism, but it supports the same diseased, corrupt, monopoly capitalistic arms and energy robbing elements, the worst of the worst. And so everybody who gets fooled by the official story is inevitably supporting this corrupt oligarchy of arms makers and spies. And I call it the diaboligarchy. And that's